call rabbi,
all the call wives, their house, and all they do for the community. Like he's saying, Rabbi Slater, who is occupying the children so we could talk tangibly about them, and in their presence, Shua Mentalist. And of course, Rabbi Barnes, who's no stranger to our Hanukkah Mitzvah. This is, I think, it's the third time that he's speaking for us on Hanukkah, and we're very grateful for that. It's interesting. If you look at the halachas that govern what we do on Hanukkah, it's a contrast with that which we do on Purim. On Purim, there's an obligation to have mishnah. We have a feast. We all know that. But we start inviting people 6 months in advance. I know that because by the time I get around to inviting people, everybody's taken. And on Hanukkah, we don't see that there's an obligation of mishnah. And this is noted amongst the poskim and it's discussed. And they offer that the nace of Hanukkah was totally different from the nace of Purim. That on the nace of Purim, we were threatened with physical annihilation. Haman didn't care if a person said, no, I'm not Jewish anymore, I don't put someone on, he was going to get him, his hands on him, and kill him. And the nace that happened, it saved their physical lives. And we're very grateful for that. And we rejoice in a physical way. And Hanukkah was just the opposite. The Yevanim, they loved the Jews, they loved their culture, they loved a lot of things about them, but they didn't like all those mitzvahs and the Torah that they kept. And they wanted to substitute that. And that's what we say in the Al Hanisim, Lashkicham Sarasacha, that they wanted to make Torah forgotten. Ulahavira Mechuke Vitanacha, and to nullify the mitzvahs. And some people really, they weren't so perturbed by that. But there was one family that got up against all odds, the Chatzmanayim, and decided that, knew and understood that life without Torah is not a life at all. And they're going to take on this mighty empire, just a little ragtag army, and come what may, that they're going to try to do what they could to preserve the life that they knew and loved. And therefore, the nace of Hanukkah, the way we internalize that, is not through eating and feasting, but shvach and haidah. Hello. Nowadays, we also have chasmanayim, people that are at the forefront of preserving Torah. These are the people that establish yeshivas and kolim, and people like Rabbi Barz that fearlessly go to the front lines. Sometimes using all types of guerrilla warfare. Maybe he'll share some of his tactics with us tonight. And we very much appreciate him coming and joining us and sharing his religion with us. Thank you.
You know, in my training, one of the things I did was I trained as a stand-up comedian. And I was in Los Angeles, in Eish HaTorah, and they had one of my students said to me, why don't we take this course? You should take this course. You can't hear me back there? I was giving a class and people in the back couldn't hear me, so everyone moved back there. So if you can't hear me, just raise your hand. That's going to be a very popular spot. So there was this course of stand-up comedy. If you want to take the course, it might help you in delivery and everything. And the graduation of the course was you had to perform in the improv. Rabbi Wint, I'm sure, doesn't know what the improv is. But the improv is the kind of stand-up comedy thing. House, there's one in Washington, and you know, if you've never done it, It's actually quite scary. There's a reason why many, many stand-up comedians, I don't want to disparage all stand-up comedians, but there's a reason why many of them are alcoholics. Because it's a lot of pressure. You're standing in front of 1,000 people, and you've got to keep them laughing all the time. It's a lot of pressure. And so, to be quite honest with you, this is more nerve-wracking than that. I was standing in front of 1,000, literally 1,000 people, and you have to keep them going. And it's much harder. One of my students is Tony Kornheiser. He said to me once, he said, it's easier for me to be funny, right? It's easier for me to be funny than it is for him. And he said, the reason is because people expect him to be funny. It's much harder. There's everybody's expectations that we're talking about. It's much harder when you expect people to be funny. You go, okay, now make me laugh. But you're expecting a rabbi to come on the ground. You know, okay, so I take my sleeping pills yet? where's the Novocaine? So now, it's much easier. So this is much more nerve-wracking than speaking in front of at the improv. But the reason is because I've got 4 daughters I have to marry off. You people are probably going to be at calls at some point. And you're going to just say, listen, don't ask me any questions. It's a recording of the whole thing. So it's a little bit more nerve-wracking. So I thought, you know, listen, Rabbi Winters, it's very generous asking me to come back 3 times. Each time I speak, I think I'm going to ruin it. And that's it, you know, and they keep inviting me back. I guess from 1 year to the next, you don't remember. So I don't know. Rabbi Winters, though, I know he's got a great memory. But anyway, I thought I'd start with the joke. You know, the interesting thing, just to give you a technique in rabbi business, well, I shouldn't say rabbi business, I can't tell you rabbi business, but just in terms of hero business, when it comes to a Devar Torah, all the Devar Torahs have to connect. You know, because at the end, people are going to come up to you, Rabbi, the first point you made didn't connect to the last point. How do you do that? You know, when it comes to a joke, they don't care. Like it has nothing to do with the subject, and you can just enjoy yourself. So with that theme, with that permission, a thief breaks into a shul just before Rosh Hashanah. And he doesn't know. It's a shul that looks like a fancy building to him. And in there he finds the rabbi, the cantor, and the president. And he's really upset, and he says, listen, I've been caught twice before. And in this state, they catch you 3 times, they throw away the key. They don't let you out. There's nothing I can do, I'm going to have to kill you. So they all break down in tears. And the cantor comes forward and he says, listen, you just can't kill me like that. He says, what do you mean? He says, well, I've been practicing all year for Kol Nidre. And I've been researching and listening to records of Rosenblatt and this and that and then come up with my own tunes and by myself alone, no one, even my wife has heard me. And if you kill me now, my soul will not rest nor haunt you for eternity. So the thief says, well, what would you want? Just let me at least give over my Kol Nidre, you know, preparation for just the 4 of us. He says, how long will this take? He says, 20 minutes, half an hour max. Looks at the clock. He says, okay, fine. With that, the rabbi steps forward. He says, listen, I've been preparing my Yom Kippur Shmuz for an entire year. I've been quoting. I've got news stories and Devar Torahs and I've been refining it and I've been preparing it and no one's heard it. If you kill me now, my soul will never rest, and I'll haunt you for all eternity. So the priest says, well, what do you want? He says, let me at least give it over to us people here. How long is this going to take? Is it 20 minutes, half an hour max? He says, okay. He turns to the president of the shul. He says, do you have a last request? He says, yes, shoot me first. So Hanukkah, I have to somehow tie in, though, that was a joke, it doesn't have to tie in, I somehow have to tie in Hanukkah, And it occurred to me that we say something on Hanukkah that doesn't appear, as the rabbi pointed out, there are differences between Hanukkah and Purim. And it occurred to me there's a difference, a very smart difference between Hanukkah and Purim. I'm sure you're all aware of the vault that Lot kept Pesach. And Rashi brings down this idea that Pesach, and the Hazal point out, the Pesach pre-existed before Yetzias Mitzrayim, before the Jewish people actually left Egypt. Because it's in the Bria, in the creation itself, there's this idea of freedom that occurs every time in the month of Nisan. It occurs, and the Jewish people had to bring that to life. It's not that we created Pesach, it's that the Pesach was there, and the Jewish people lived it. And the same idea would exist by Hanukkah. It's not just that the Jews created Hanukkah. Hanukkah's there, and they had to bring it out. The Hashmonaim had to bring it out. In other words, when you're in the front lines of Kiruv, you're in Kolalim, you're in Eshetor and other organizations that are special and meaningful and holy, you're the few that are fighting the masses. I'm going to do a lot of fundraising. It gives me a special kind of heartburn when I hear about people who give away money, huge, vast amount of money for absolute nonsense that doesn't have any impact or meaning on the existence of the world. And here we all know there isn't a kollel in existence that is, wondering which stocks they should invest their savings in. That's not part of the board meetings. We're all struggling and it's all difficult. But I think that maybe this is the way it's supposed to be, that the end of this galus is going to be the story of the few that had to battle the many. So this is how it's supposed to be, that for the Jewish people to be saved, and the way the Almighty wants it to work, is it has to be the few. In other words, if all the Jewish people, there's a midrash that says that the number of Hashmonaim was just a few handfuls, there was a few people. But if there had been thousands or hundreds of thousands of Jews that fought the Greeks, that would not have been Hanukkah. That would have been something else. It had to be that it would only be a few. Maybe it has to be that this is the way that we have to save the Jewish people. To make the impact that we're going to make is to be the few. This is how the Almighty is going to direct us and have his hashpah on the Jewish people for the few. Of course, I'd like a few with a big budget, but that's maybe how it's going to be. And the parsha we're going to read, not this Shabbat, but the one coming up, by Yigash, there's a line in there, my Rosh Hashiva tzal. He explains a very famous line that Yehuda comes to Joseph and he says to him the famous line, he explains to him that you can't take Benjamin, because if you take Benjamin, then our father back in Eretz Yisrael, back in the land of Canaan, it will kill him. And Yosef, of the long, long story we've been reading, all these chapters, finally cannot take him anymore. And he says to Yehuda, Ani Yosef, the very famous line, Ani Yosef, Ha'od Avihar, is my father still alive? And of course, the question doesn't make any sense. I am Joseph, is my father still alive? The whole argument that Yehuda has been making is if you take Benjamin, it will kill our father. So I wrote to Shiva, he pointed out, it's not a question. It's a rhetorical question. I am Joseph. And the Chazal says that when we get upstairs, this is the first question the Almighty is going to ask us. This is what the Almighty is going to say to us. The same thing that Yosef said to Yehuda. Ani Yosef, Ha'od Avihai, is going to turn to us and say, I am God. In that same refrain, the Yosef said, I am Joseph. Did you think about whether it would kill our father when you sold me into slavery? Is our father still alive? In other words, when you wanted to think, you could think about Benjamin and be worried about Yaakov, our father. But when you sold me, it didn't bother you. It was a rationalization, and for that Yehuda had no answer. So how does this relate to marriage? So, parenting, how does this relate? So my nephew's husband, my nephew-in-law, so his father's a moyle in Manchester, England. I don't know if you know anything about Manchester, England, so let me give you a little bit of a description. Manchester is like Pittsburgh, but on a bad day. That's Manchester. And he lives in Manchester. And, you know, outside of London, where I'm from, it's sort of like how, I'm sorry, I don't want to sound rude or anything, but you know how New Yorkers think about everybody else? You know, sort of out of town. But that's how you think. I'm from London, that's how you think, right? And it's a large part pretty much true. In England, it's true, right? So he's in Manchester, and there's just nothing in Manchester. It's a full community, and that's kind of it. If you're Jewish and you're not from, you're just gone. There's nothing there. There's very little going on. Very assimilated. And Kribi Zamoyle, he gets calls now and again to do these briefs in that are very assimilated people. Anyway, he gets this one phone call one time. He tells me the story from this woman who is, she says to him, Rabbi, I need to have my son have Sabbath. She says, how old is the boy? 30 days old. So now you already don't have a rush. His 8 days is gone. She says, okay, well, maybe next week we'll schedule. No, it has to be today. So she's from Leeds, which is also, it's like Manchester, but worse. So he says, well, today we've got to be during the daytime. We've got 3 hours. If you can get him here, then we can do it, right? He says, there's one condition. The father has to agree. I have to get the permission of the father. I'm not going to do a grift on a boy and without the okay of the father, right? You don't want to get sued. So the mother says, that's not possible. That's not going to happen. He says, if it's not going to happen, I'm not doing a grift. Right? And she's arguing with him for 10 minutes. Finally, she realizes she's not getting anywhere. She says, I'll call you back. 5 minutes later, he gets a phone call. Now, you know, in America, I've learned to be politically correct. Mostly because my wife is sitting next to me and I have bruises. So, there's no politically correct way to say this because there's no African Americans in England. They don't call them African English. It just doesn't exist. There's no, it just says, you're black. It's just, that's the way, sorry, that's what they say in England. You understand? It's in England. Right? So this black guy calls, is on the phone, and he says to this rabbi, he says, I'll agree for you to circumcise my son on one condition. What's that? No Hebrew. No Hebrew, no blessings, nothing. You can cut him, this is his language he's using, but no Hebrew. So the rabbi says, fine, no problem. So she comes down, and he goes over the top with smoked herring. Like, it's got the Kiftei She'Eliyahu, he's doing all the brachas you never heard of. He's just throwing it on because he's going to make sure this kid's got extra, right? And it's just schmaltz and everything. Kiddish, the whole world. He's like everything, right? And he did the birth. Of course, the father wasn't there. You understand? About 6 months later, somehow the mother must have let it slip and the father finds out. And he gets a phone call from this guy. And it's like the light was the one, I don't know if you remember, a few years ago, the internet went down. Like, that was this guy's phone call. Like, the phone was burning. With all, he couldn't tell me the language he used. Because it was just going on and on. For 10 minutes, he's screaming at this rabbi for what he did to his son. You understand? Now, he's saying to me, you can get sued in England for giving a brit, for certain, but you can't get sued even in England for making a blotter. Like, you know, what's he going to do? You understand? So after 10 minutes, he finally calms down, and he asks him, why on earth did you agree to let your son be circumcised if you're so anti the whole thing? He says, Rabbi, there's only one reason I agreed. And that is, for 30 days straight, my wife cried every single day till I would agree to give him to circumcise him. He didn't use the word this. 30 days straight. So we all know there's a Talmud that says that the poor people are going to come upstairs and they're going to, and their wife is going to say, did you learn Torah? And they're going to say, we didn't have time, it was tough, we didn't have money. And your wife is going to pull out Hillel. Because no one was poorer than Hillel. And yet he became the great Hillel. And he goes through various examples. I hold that the Almighty is keeping this black guy somewhere up, in some little box somewhere, right? And women are going to come upstairs, and they're going to say, the Almighty is going to say, did you get your husband to learn? Did you get your children to learn? And they're going to say, no! My husband wouldn't listen to me. And the Almighty going to call out this black guy. He says, no, that's not an excuse. Because my wife got me, and I'm an anti-Semite. I don't like Jews. You understand? He's willing to give his son a brit, but no Hebrew. But I understand you're against, I mean, it's not right, but unless I understand the mentality of someone who doesn't want to give his son a brit. It's wrong. You're not advocating that, obviously. Right? I'm in the wrong place. But if he is willing to do that, but no Hebrew, what does he think the Hebrew's going to do? Going to affect his son? Is it? The guy's obviously an anti-Semite. You understand? A deep answer. Took him 30 days. He didn't have a problem with the bliss. He didn't have a problem with the servant. He doesn't want Hebrew. You understand? It took her 30 days. And she finally got him. You understand? There's nothing you can't get your husband to do if she could get him to do that. I guess it's the last time. So with that introduction, how I teach parenting is I tell people that everybody I meet is a great parent. They all know what to do. They're just doing it with the wrong person. People are great parents with their spouses. And they're great spouses with their children. People know what to do. That's what Yosef was telling Yehuda. You have it within you. You have it there. We have the strength within us. Hillel could do it. This guy could do it. This woman could do it. We're just doing it with the wrong people. In other words, we are great parents. We're doing it with the wrong person. We are great spouses. We could get our spouses to do anything we want because we apply those skills to our children. So I'm going to show you five examples that I use, although there are many more, and I call it MAPA, learning marriage from parenting and parenting from marriage. And there are five examples. The first one is what I call quality time versus quantity time. Quality time, and this was very big in the 70s, the 1970s, not the 80s, I'm not that old. In the 1970s, they came out, they said, listen, you have two parents working now, so you don't have as much quantity time with your children, at least have quality time. A few minutes focused conversation with your kids will make up for all of it. And this is absolute nonsense, because children don't want quality time with their parents. They don't want to speak to you. Nothing personal, right? My kids too. But they like you being around. They just don't want to talk to you. And this is not so strange. Many of us have the same relationship with our own parents. We love it when our parents come over, but they don't bother us that much. Here, Mom, come on in, sit down, have a cup of coffee. I'll put an opera for you. Here's a cookie, maybe not an opera, whatever it happens to be. Right? We love our parents being around, but like I'm busy. And they want to talk. They want to have quality time. Spouses, it's the exact opposite. With spouses, spouses don't need quantity time. What they need is quality time. A few minutes focused conversation with eye contact makes up for everything. So you see, the classic breakfast cereal morning, you know, you're reading the back of the Wall Street Journal about a stock you don't even own, and your wife is trying to talk to you about the family vacation, and you're giving the yes-no answer, hoping that you haven't bought into Outer Bounds, right? Your son sits down, and he starts reading the back of a cereal box that he's read 14 times before, and you start asking him, how's it going in school? Who are your friends? How are your grades going? Is your ready? Blah, 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 blah. Right? And he's giving you the same yes, no answer. We know how to have quality time. We do it with our children. So many people come up to me saying, Rabbi, my husband, my wife, all they want to talk about is whatever they're interested in. And I say to them, well, your six-year-old son, what do you talk to him about? Right? Whether the dollar should go on the gold standard? No! I told him Barney the dinosaur, or Thomas the Tank, we've got the songs down. Right? Because when it comes to your kids, you talk about what their interests, and it's an inverse relationship, by the way. In other words, the younger your children are, the more they want to talk to you. But the closer they get to anything you want to talk to, the older they get, the less they want to talk to you. It's an inverse relationship. You know, the classic thing, you come home from a business trip, you're exhausted, you collapse on the couch, it's 11:30 at night, your wife comes over, it goes both ways, your wife comes over and says, you know, we need to buy a new van. Oh, you know, you're right, oh, but I'm totally zonked, I can't think of it. This weekend, half an hour, we'll calm down, we'll discuss it. At that moment, your 10-year-old son comes down the stairs, crying his eyes out because his best friend is distant in school, and he doesn't want to go on anymore. You sit up, bolt upright, and you sit in a half an hour speech about how the same thing happened to you when you were in high school, and your best friend just showed us the best thing that ever happened to you because he turned out to be a mafioso kingpin and spent 10 years in jail. When your kids want to talk, you want to listen and engage. We know how to have quality time. We do it with our children. We know how to have quantity time. We know how to just sit there and not engage. We do it with our spouses. So this is a little trick, but don't tell your spouse you're doing it. When your spouse walks in the door, pretend it's your son or your daughter. Just in your mind, don't tell them you're doing it, and you'll be amazed how interested you are in what they're doing. How was shopping, dear? And how did it go in school? And how's work? And is that contract coming? You'll be amazed how interested it is. And when your son or your daughter walks through the door, pretend it's yourself. You'll be amazed how disinterested you are in what they're doing. Chill out, here, go read the paper, enjoy yourself, you're going to play over here, it's fine, you're leaving the love. I just actually got off the phone with his father. Every time his son walks in the door, he just questions him. He's driving the kid crazy. The kid finally moved out the house. I had to tell him, just let him be. Stop bugging him for quality time. He doesn't want to talk to you. He likes coming home. He just doesn't want to talk to you. We know how to do it. We're doing it with the wrong person. Okay, that's number one. You can question me, by the way. Anything you have is not clear. Rabbi Winter is free here to answer. So the second one is give and take. Give and take is an oxymoron. There's no such thing as give and take. There's give or there's take. There's no give and take. Marriage is not give and take. Marriage is just give. And we all know how to do that because we do that with our children. You never heard this line, I'm not getting anything out of this relationship. If you're a rabbi, right, you've had people calling you, rabbi, I can't take it anymore, I'm not getting anything out of this relationship. And you never heard that line from a mother. No mother in the history of the world ever turned to a 16-year-old son and say, son, I'm not getting anything out of this relationship. Right? Because no mother ever thinks, like, so what? Right? Can you put me up for adoption? I just want 3 meals a day in a corner room with a view. That'll be fine by me. No woman, no parent ever said to their children, I'm not getting anything out of this relationship. When it comes to children, that's an absurdity. Yet when it comes to your spouse, we think that's a meaningful response. I'm not getting anything out of this relationship. And you know, so many people say to me, I give to my spouse more than I get. And the answer obviously is, no you don't. Because you're not giving anything. You see, when I go to the store and I give them money and I take this, right, that's not give and take, that's just take. I'd rather not give them anything, but it's shoplifting. You see, I have someone that cleans our home. Right? And we pay her. And the reason we pay her is because she can't get decent help these days. I'd rather not pay her at all. It doesn't work like that. If you have a deal with your spouse, I'll do the dishes if you make dinner. That's not give and take. That's just take because I'd rather not do the dishes. If you're not going to make dinner. If you're keeping track, as Everton Youngroyd points out, if you're keeping track of what you're getting, you're not into give, you're just into take. She says, couples today don't need marriage counselors, they need accountants. You've got more closet space than me. Yes, but your mother comes over more than my mother. Right? And we do more things that you like, and the grand room is painted like you wanted it. And we have your dinners, and I don't like those dinners. When it comes to children, we're into give, and we know how to do that. You know the worst thing your children will ever say to you your entire life? Donald was asked all at once, pick a number. What's the worst thing your kids will ever say to you your entire life? Anybody? Pick a number. Alphabetical order, oldest to youngest. You've never done anything for me. No, you missed the question. I didn't mean this week. The worst thing your kids will ever say to your entire life. But as we say, be careful how you choose the children. They're picking out the nursing home. Okay? What's the worst thing your children ever say to your entire life? Anybody? Nobody? Come on. Worst thing your kids have ever said to your entire life. Come on. You hate you. Right. That's the same as a week. You know like prison? You know, prison is like your place where people learn to be better crooks. Right? And nothing against school. Rabbi says, totally for a minute. But school's like that. You know, your kids come back with lines to get you, but they must have learned in school. Because they go to school the next day, oh, I've got my dad. Oh, shit, he's got him. He gave me, he took me out for donuts and ice cream. Why? Well, it's just wrong. He's gone out of school. Now everyone's saying it. They just got to figure out the line. What's the worst thing your kid will ever say to you? Don't help me anymore. That's the worst thing your kid can ever say to your entire life. Don't believe me, call up your mother and say, Mom, I need your advice. Can you help me out? We're thinking of buying a minivan. 2 weeks later, she'll be round with a spreadsheet of 15 minivans, cross-reference, right, with test drives. Your mom, you change your mind again. Here it is. You make her weak. Right? The worst thing is everyone needs to be needed. When it comes to our children, the worst thing they're going to say is, I'm healthy anymore. You know, people say to me, I ask you all the time, could you ever leave your children? How can I leave my children? They need me so much. It's my husband. She's so needy. The same thing is a virtue by your kids to pay your rent when it comes to the salary. Because you've got to be needed. You want to be needed. Marriage is how you know how to do it. You do it with your children. Okay, that's number three, give and take. Number three is survival and success. When it comes to children, we are in success mode. There is nothing your children will ever show you or say to you or happen to them that you aren't going to conquer. Whatever it happens to be, they got a problem with calculus, with math, whatever, you put that up to save your life, you're going to figure out how to solve it. Right? When it comes to yourself, you're into survival mode. Survival mode's like this. If your spouse is giving you a problem, the first question you ask yourself is, can I live with it? And if the answer is yes, you don't do anything about it. It's survival mode. When it comes to your children, you do whatever it takes to solve the problem. You'll meet somebody who never graduated high school, and you haven't seen them in 20 years, and they're lobbying in Congress to get new law passed about some DNA experimental drug for East African whooping cough. You never heard of it before. And you ask her, how do you know so much about this disease? And she'll say to you, my son has it. And when it comes to your children, there's nothing you don't do to solve the problem. When it comes to yourself, you live with it. You don't live with problems when it comes to your children. And this is a true story. I know of a couple that had a genetic disorder. It took them 12 years. They cured their child. They weren't predisposed to solve it. But they had 12 years to cure a genetic disorder, which I'm told is not like just taking more vitamins, or as you would say, vitamins. The major thing. The couple eventually got divorced. I don't know what were the issues between them, but it wasn't a degree of genetic disorder. When it comes to our children, there's no idea that we don't solve the problem. We figure out how to solve it. When it comes to our spouse, again, that's the way they are. Right? You don't live with the problems of your spouses. You solve them. That's survival and success. What's number four? What I call technique and caring. Technique and caring. You know, this was started by a guy in, the Russians actually came up with this. They said, they don't believe in God, so they said, what's the best way to raise children? Right? You should have experts raising children. I mean, after all, what do we know about raising children? We've got to have experts. They have experts for everything. So they started boarding schools in Russia that were run by, so to speak, experts in parenting. Experts in parenting. People sent their kids there not because they were indigent or they didn't care, but they wanted to give their kids the best. In fact, they did the same kind of thing in Israel. And they did the same thing in America. In Israel and Russia, the system fell apart. We don't do it anymore because it's crazy. But in America, they still do it. It was started by a very famous doctor. Anyone know his name? Anybody? How old is he?
Mark.
What?
Mark.
Dr. Barr? No, Dr. Spock. Right? A Star Trek fan. This is Dr. Spock. Right? Dr. Spock, he started, he said like this, I'm going to raise your children for you. Right? I'm not actually going to take them, but you're going to work for me, and I'm going to tell you what to do. As though you're complete imbecile. Like, America was overwhelmed with psychopaths. Right? And like, you know, people followed it. Right? And I don't believe that the ratio of psychopaths went down much. It's what I call technique parenting. Right? And the truth of the matter is, I like to give a ratio to it, although it's a little difficult. The problem with this is 80% of the effectiveness of raising children has nothing to do with technique. It has to do with caring. If you don't care about your children, the best technique in the world isn't going to help. And the opposite is true. When it comes to spouses, it's the exact opposite. 80% of your effectiveness with your spouse is technique, not caring. But it's interesting, because when it comes to our children, we're very much invested in improving our technique. You walk into anyone's home, and they've got rocks and sharks and all kinds of things for their children. But their spouses have to make it on their own. We're very good on technique with our children. We know how to improve technique, we should improve our technique with our spouses. I see we're getting invaded here, so I'm going to go to the last point, which is my favorite, which is when you get married, people say this idea to you. It's one of the worst pieces of marriage advice you can hear. And it is, be careful what you say to your spouse, because they may forgive, but they never forget. Right? You know the old joke about when my, not my wife, but someone's wife, someone I know called me up, right? So your wife may, when my wife gets a little angry with me, she becomes a little historical. Don't you mean hysterical? No, historical. She remembers everything. Right? And it goes both ways, Right? So be careful what you say to yourself, and this is totally not true. How do you know it's not true? Because when it comes to your children, not only do you forget what they do to you, not only do you forgive them, but if you remember, it becomes a remnant. You remember fondly the time that your son drove the station wagon over the Grand Canyon and you had to walk 15 miles through in the Hobby Desert and grandma nearly died of dehydration. But you were seeing your son go away, and that's the best vacation of your life. Right? It's a remnant. Your wife gets a dent in the car for 50 years. You'll remember the dent in the car. Right? The car was 25 years old, and you couldn't notice the dent, but you've got a dent in the car. I remember once I was teaching this class, and we'll leave this on this point, and the woman said to me, she was in the pool with her daughter. Her daughter's about 8 years old. And the daughter said to her, Mommy, I don't love you anymore. Oh, kids, what I say, the darndest thing. So I said to the woman, what did you say to your daughter? So she said, I just said, you know, that's not the kind of thing you say to Mommy. So, and then what did you do? She looked at me like I'm crazy. What do you mean, and then what did I do? That was it. I said, that was it? Imagine if the husband came home and you open the door to greet him and he turns to you and he says, Honey, I have to tell you the truth. I don't love you anymore. But you got really mad. I must have hit a raw nerve. Right? You would slam the door in his face, he'd call him for his plane, he'd bang him on the door, 4 hours later, you finally open the letterbox. What is it? I just got to give me 5 minutes of talk. So you put the door on the chain. Yes, what is it? I've had a stinking headache. My boss chewed me out. I got a ticket going to work. 3 customers canceled their orders. On the way back, I got a flat tire. I'm having the worst day of my life. Please forget that I ever said that I don't love you anymore. And this woman laughed, because she knows, I may one day forgive you, but I will go into my grave remembering the dead. It's going to be engraved on your forehead. You're going to be wearing this an anvil around your shoulders the day you say, I don't love you anymore. Because when it comes to our children, not only do we forgive, not only do we forget, but if we remember it's a remnant. With our spouses, it's a complete opposite. The worst thing you can say to your children, that's it. Go to bed without dinner. And he's upstairs, 12 years old, reading comics. He wasn't even hungry. But 2 o'clock in the morning, you can't sleep having pictures of child protective services with helicopters coming into the door. Because your emaciated son passed out of school. So finally you go upstairs, you bang open the door, and you say to him, say you're sorry right now. And he knows he's got you. And he says, no, I'm not like you. I have principles. So you say to him, okay, whisper it. Just whisper it. He says, no, I have scruples. Okay, wave your hand in the air, I'm sorry. And he picks up his hand in some gesture, and you know, all is forgiven, it comes downstairs, and you never mention it another day of your life. But when it comes to the spouse, we want it in blood, we want it in grace, we want it in tune, we want it in concrete, we want it in some tattoo on his forehead. We know how to let our spouses, we know how to let our spouses off. It isn't the words they have to find for us to forgive them and let it go. Because we know how to do it with our children. It's within us to do it ourselves. We have the secret. We know how to do it. And that gap between what we do to our children, what we do to our spouses, that's the bliss. Happy Hanukkah. I'd like to do it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the words and the ladies and gentlemen. Dancing, the reflection, the classes.